thing I want to say before I get started is that the Morin Academy has got some new things that we're going to roll out in the next couple of months. And one to keep on your radar screen is that we're going to start a Patreon. And we're still formulating the tiers, but one of the things we want to do is offer a tier where subscribers get all of our live content. And I'm going to start doing monthly live talks where people will get a chance as subscribers to ask questions, have some interaction with me and with others. We're going to have more classes that are going to be done by Morin Academy fellows and associates. So anyway, keep that on your radar screen. Be looking for more information about that. And you can always go to the Morin Academy website, which I will link below. So, but I want to continue with chapter one and go into chapter two of D.C. Schindler's The Politics of the Real, The Church Between Liberalism and Integralism. And he starts off just talking a little bit about why, in his view, the liberal concept of toleration misses the mark. So he says that the pure potentializing of God, the idea of God as pure potential, the generic God of liberalism, is the deep cause of religious violence. He says, we have been taught that truth claims are dangerous, but as a matter of historical fact and demonstrable intrinsic logic, it is only opinions that are violent. Any claim that imposes itself by force, that by that fact ceases to be a truth claim and reveals itself to be a mere opinion. So this part of the argument, I am not sure I can yet quite accept. I thought of how the Hebrews, the Israelites, who believed that they had the one true God behind them, fought with others who had a similar idea that they had true gods or gods, and actually viewed confronting the Israelites as kind of a battle between those gods, with the idea that whoever won had the true God. So I think it's possible for people, because religion has so much to do with revelation, and when something is revealed to you, then you believe it or you embrace it in its fullness. When God is revealed to you, either through direct revelation or through the scriptural teachings, you are able to embrace it. It becomes your faith. I think there is an aspect of this that allows for people to have these truth claims competing with each other, and that this is a legitimate cause of violence. It's regrettable, and it's one that liberalism tried to eliminate through the concept of toleration. But I don't know if liberalism or its effect of potentializing God is the deep cause of religious violence. It's one cause, but I don't know as I can accept that it is the cause. But moving on to an area where Schindler's thought is more convincing, and a lot of this is really good, really thought-provoking. He discusses how in Greek thought, there is this concept of the hierarchy of being, in which the lower orders of being are to be interpreted in light of the higher. So for instance, in Platonic thought, that the forms, and especially the highest form of the good, illuminate all the other lower forms, okay, creating this hierarchy. In Aristotelian thought, the forms no longer exist in their metaphysical reality, but nature supplies the forms, and Aristotle is the originator of the natural law idea, right? And the human beings, for instance, are higher than animals because they have reason, and human flourishing is only occurs in community, which is thought to be that the city state is the highest level, in his view, of human ordering, and all lower human orders, human organizations such as the family, are geared towards participating in that higher order and only reach their their full flourishing in a good city state, properly governed, and so on and so forth. I could go on, but basically, yes, right? In Greek thought, there's this notion of hierarchy in which the lower things can only fully flourish with the fruition of the higher things, and are to be seen in light of those things towards which they tend, towards which they grow, and in which they flourish. So he says, what happens when the highest principle of all gets reinterpreted, no longer as pure act or the real, but now more basically as potency, first as absolute potential, then as generic truth expressed incompletely in a variety of traditions, and then finally as an option, the possible object of, quote, religious preference. This is on page 32. He says, on the one hand, when this happens, the lower appears as more real than the higher then. And so rather than the lower receiving its most basic meaning from the higher, now the higher gets interpreted as a function of the lower. God gets reconceived as a function of religion, for instance, religion as a function of human culture, culture as social construct, society as psychology, psychology as neurobiology, neurobiology as configurations of physical events as, quote, accidental collections of atoms, and so forth. So he captures something great there about how the modern mind has overturned this older notion of the hierarchy of being, and now literally has reduced everything to kind of incoherent, unconscious, physical matter. This is Hobbes in a nutshell, Hobbes's view of the world. Right? And therefore, nothing really comes from ultimate meaning and purpose. There is no answer to why, right? There's only things that exist, and they are the building blocks of everything else. But as far as why, we can't answer that question. So this becomes a theme. Now there's a point not long after that quote where Schindler takes the time to do kind of a litany of liberalism's fallout. Some of these items are more immediately connectable to the emergence of liberalism and the way of thinking of liberalism than others. For instance, he talks about a basic, restless, radical mobility. So if we have reached a point where there is no hierarchy of being or order or purpose, answer to why, you know, then everybody is kind of free, everything and everybody is free to kind of bump into whatever they want, right? So of course, that means thinking of the world as kind of infinite choice, right? The individual can choose whatever they want, or at least should be able to do so. And that tends to foster a restlessness and radical mobility. Participation, he says, or membership in a reality larger than oneself, is regularly trumped not so much by the reality of the individual as by the activity of self-assertion. Self-assertion becomes how you can even understand yourself as an individual in the world, right? And it becomes the primary act, the act of self-assertion, which often these days takes on the aspect of just choice, and choice at a very mundane level, of, you know, choosing what I'm going to wear today or what I'm going to buy, you know, like your consumer choice. We have an abstract sense of equality. And he says an all-encompassing drag towards materialism, of course, right? A sense that transcendence has become more or less lost altogether, or he says, sentimentalized. And the list goes on. Some of the things on the list are less immediately obvious and would need more connections for me. but I could even do the connecting. And I don't think that he wants to take the time to do that here, but he wants people to think. So he mentions things like urban sprawl and architectural styles and how different they are, the modern architectural style, how geared it is to efficiency. He talks about art fragmenting into the sentimental or the edgy, and so on. Another point where he makes that's more immediately obvious to me is the political authority is reduced to the state, right? There is no more authority. Authority has to do with people recognizing the legitimacy of rules, right? So the authority of the Middle Ages, to the extent that it existed, came from either a belief that the state was tied up with God through the church, or that the people in charge of the state had a nobility, a sort of, you might say, inherited superiority and wisdom relative to others. And once that is gone and the state becomes a matter of, as he says somewhere in here, a social contract where each individual decides somehow to give tacit or direct consent to their government to form a government, which can be anything as long as they agree to it, then the state's quote authority comes from either that individual consent, i.e. it's my authority, right? Or it's just the power of the state to make you do what it wants. And actually, we experience it in our modern liberal world as a combination of those two things. Sometimes we think of it as it's doing these things on my behalf as an individual who gives my at least tacit consent as a citizen, or I don't like what it's doing, and it's just because it's powerful that I have to obey it. So I like this list. I think it's very thought-provoking, even some of the things that are not terribly as easily to connect are thought-provoking, such as he says, education ceases to be about the formation of a person, right? The formation of a person would only be able to be coherently conducted if you knew what they were being formed for, right? Towards some natural end, right? The telos, you might say, the ideal, which implies that there's some higher order, that maybe there's a creator, right, that has created that order in a certain way. And so you know what the individual should be sort of formed towards, right? Now education is the preparation of the individual with tools to make the choices that he or she wants to make in order to conduct business of their own lives as they see fit, right? So this is why colleges of liberal arts are in such a mess right now, is because slowly over time, the idea that education is there to partly form the person, right? To make their lives deeper and richer, to give them a sense of who they are in the world and where they belong. All that's been more or less eroded by the liberal notion of the individual and their freedom of individual choice. All right, so that's some of the fallout that he sees. Now, in addition to saying that, though, right after that, he wants to say that he recognizes that there's no going back. So he wants to say he's not a romantic. He's not trying to be like William Blake here with, the protest against modernity in the form of wanting to return to that previous supposedly idyllic existence. So he says, in the first place, history is real and will remain real, so that any attempt at recovering old forms will always turn out to reinvent them in some respect, to embody them in a new way from within the embracing horizon of the contemporary age. In a word, there is no going back. Ironically, the desire simply to reproduce old forms, as if these were detachable items that could be chosen as alternatives to what is otherwise given, is itself, and in spite of itself, an expression of liberalism. I would back off a bit and say it's an expression of modernity, right? And I say that because I'm thinking of fascism, you know, both the 20th century variety as well as that which is emerging now. And, you know, you get the feeling from looking at the fascist elements, the ideological elements, that it is a concocted thing that nevertheless tries to hark back to a mythologized past, right? But it feels very artificial. And it ultimately always must rely upon physical force to impose itself on people for that very reason. So fascism is one of these attempts to go back in a way and prove Schindler's point that it is a very modern expression, right? There is no going back. And in the attempt to just go back, you create these monstrosities. So whatever he's aiming at is not simply going to be going back or reclaiming some sort of feudal or aristocratic past, and has to be whatever it is that he envisions would have to be organically emergent out of what currently is, and not a concoction. How we would ever get to whatever that is yet to be seen. He also wants to say that there are some good fruits that come along with liberalism. He doesn't go so far as to say that they come from liberalism. In fact, he wants to explicitly say that he denies they come from liberalism. There are no fruits of liberalism directly. So the label there is probably a little bit of a misnomer, but there are some good things, and he lists some of them that have kind of arisen up at this time. He says the extension of opportunity to previously neglected groups. So, for instance, the extension of opportunities to women, to various minority groups as well. These would be goods that have emerged in contemporary life, in tandem, at least, with liberalism. You know, I'm willing to argue liberalism, at least in a half-assed way, has done that. But he's not quite willing to say that. He also connects a new sensitivity to personal dignity, and also the discovery of genuine selfhood and individual uniqueness beyond absorption into group identity. There, I mean, we have to say there an ideal has emerged in liberalism or in this time of individual uniqueness that's beyond the absorption into group identity. But actually, ironically, and I'm sure Schindler knows this as well, but like, you know, as Tocqueville pointed out, even in the 19th century, ironically, the opposite has actually occurred, that the ideal never has emerged, but rather people have been absorbed into mass and group identity for the most part. And so they seek their very weakened individualism, their weakened individuality through these means, especially now, it seems like, you know, through consumerism and various temporary identities, right? There's a sort of desperate flailing about for a sense of uniqueness, but it just is always so evasive. And he also says things like, you know, that have come along actually in opposition to homogenization and all of these, you know, less than desirable traits of liberalism, things like local communities, natural food production, homeschooling movements, and the like. These are all things that have emerged as sort of pushback to it. And also, and just because, you know, you have to like a guy who also says, who could fail to see a benefit to humanity in the proliferation of craft breweries? Indeed, and there is a serious point there, all things craft are, again, a push back against modernity's attempt to homogenize us and make us all drink Keystone Lights or whatever. So then in the next chapter, he begins the process of unfolding the fact that, in his view, America was not founded by Orthodox Christians. It is not a Christian nation. The founding is not a Christian event, but rather a revolution against Christianity. Okay, now that is just like going to be mind-blowing to some folks. It's not going to be a surprise to others. Although coming from Schindler, an Orthodox Christian of sorts, it might be a surprise to those others as well. He's going to be talking about America's freedom from God. America's kind of the spearhead of a revolution against God. And the Declaration of Independence is the first indication of that revolution, right? Because it talks about nature's God. So, you know, the traditionalist Christian of the patriotic variety tends to like read into that the historical Judeo-Christian God. But actually, that was not the intent of liberal theorists, and it wasn't the intent of the American founders. The intent of both of them was to genericize God so that we could take God out of the public space and the social space of agreement and turn that God towards the individual privacy, the privacy of your own home, of the kitchen table, where people could decide as individuals or in their own families what they believed and come out the door and leave it there at home so that they could do business, okay? So nature's God is the God, as Schindler says, of absolute potential, but nothing specific. Everybody can have their own idea of who God is and keep the peace. Nature's God facilitates, quote, the emancipation of the political order from God, if by God we mean the specific God who emerges in history in Judeo-Christian tradition, and I would say even the Islamic tradition as well, as a tradition of the book. He says Christianity, and in principle any other religion, is allowed to stand in the liberal order, though now in a manner that requires it to surrender its philosophic and theological substance. Okay. And he says this banishment of religion to the surface, where it can live at peace with a core that is putatively isolated from God, is the hallmark of liberalism. Okay, so by putting that religion on the kitchen table and not in the public square, so to speak, right? Not making it a matter of conversation for the society to try to coalesce around and agree around so that we can keep the peace, right? That isolates, right, the society from anybody's concept of God. That is the hallmark of liberalism. And you can see how that would erode even the faithful's faith over time. If you leave it at the door, or you leave it in the privacy of your own heart, right, then over time it becomes a matter of mere opinion and not a truth claim. It acts in this way, right? So the liberal God, again, it's a generic God, right? And Schindler says that the appeal then is not to the actual Christian tradition, but to a God that everyone can accept. And that is the genius of it. It's a hollowed out God, right? That everyone can accept. But in the process of this, of referencing this type of God, the generic God, the God of nature, it betrays all actual religions, because all actual religions, not just the ones of the book, make claims based on traditions that are rooted in history, human history, in particular events at particular times. And they claim particular truths, beliefs, that people hold to be true. Okay. In the case of Christianity, this makes, he says, the truth of the Christian tradition a secondary matter, at least for the political order. And he's referring not just to the Catholic Church as a tradition, although he is doing that, but, and this is what makes it a little more challenging to non-Catholics, he's also referring to Judeo-Christian tradition, as in starting with the history that really starts all the way back with creation, right? And runs through the history of the Jewish people from that point on, right? Through the incarnation, the coming into the world, according to the Christian tradition, of God in a particular place and time through a particular woman, very particular human relations, all the way through all of the events of the life of Christ through the crucifixion and the resurrection. These are very particular events and claims of truth, right? They cannot be encompassed by this generic nature's God. Now, that may be a maneuver that people needed to make in order to keep the peace. But even if you think that's the case, it doesn't obviate that point that was just made, that it is not the same God, and that you are making maneuver to keep the peace. And it is a maneuver that's corrosive to faith and particularities. Okay, that's a point that Schindler wants to make. The Judeo-Christian God, he says, is not an indeterminate power outside of nature, but reveals himself in nature through natural law and through incarnation and through the actual reality of the tradition and all of its particularity, which is the Jewish and Christian history and revelation, scriptural revelation. Whereas the God of science, the God of the Enlightenment, he says, removes the formal and final causes of things, the intrinsic meaning and the purpose, and reduces nature to the realm of quantification or mathematics, which is what Galileo here did as he studied the moons of Jupiter, okay, or as he tried to figure out laws of motion, okay. It was about observation of physical reality and the quantification of it, or the tracking of data. And that has its place. But what Galileo didn't presume to do is ask why. He didn't ask about the origin, why these things happen, and science doesn't. But the scientific frame of mind, as it took hold, began to argue that those why questions were illegitimate or couldn't be answered, right? And liberalism is fully compatible with that frame of mind. Those things can't be answered to our satisfaction, so we put them aside, we don't ask them, we get on with political science, which is the liberal social contract, which doesn't need to have reference to that, doesn't need to ask those ordering questions, like what is the political order ordered to? What does it point to? What its full flourishing is? What should human beings ultimately be doing with their lives? We don't have to ask those questions. They can't be answered, right? So this scientific frame of mind paved the way for liberalism, paved the way for a reduction of natural law to the bare minimum of the imperatives of survival and self-interest, because that's what you can absorb and quantify, so to speak. You can observe scientifically in human behavior is the same sort of instincts that govern the animal kingdom and actually the plant kingdom, survival. And then, of course, its expression in self-interest, rational self-interest, at least in the ideal, right? The liberal thinks in terms of rational self-interest. So we see the emergence of modern liberal natural right, okay? In which nature is seen as ordered only to preserving its own existence and not to a higher good. Again, we're not going to ask what should the political order be for? What kind of human being do we want to develop within it? What will actually make people happy? Because those questions are now individualized. It's not there's a way to make people happy, just as there's not an education that can help people discover their humanity. Instead, individuals can decide for themselves what will make them happy and what their flourishing will look like. But what we can all agree on is that we first have to be alive to have the freedom to do that. So natural right comes to replace natural law, and it is about self-preservation. Human beings are then seen as ordered to their own individual self-preservation, and that's why they would contemplate making a contract to produce the state, which can then keep the peace and give them, enforce their rights. Okay, this means that culture can be separated from this social contract and this liberal order, and it can be universalized. That is, the liberal order can be universalized, and it can be spread all over the world. It will apply to any and all cultures. And this means that culture ultimately is itself nothing but a human product. It's a human creation. Traditions can be changed. And in fact, now that we've discovered how powerful the human mind is and human choices, we can create our own traditions, right? We can create our modern ideologies. They become a substitute for traditions that have been built up organically over thousands and thousands of years. So at this point, you can see again how radically revolutionary this is, right? For Christianity, since that's the topic of this book, right? It's a revolution against Christianity, because Christianity is inseparable from tradition, from history, from the things that have happened before, and also how they've been taken and interpreted, okay? And so it is not terribly compatible with the idea of natural right. Schindler writes, nature's God is the ultimate pivot that allows man, apparently for the first time in human history, to extract himself from every possible cultural context in principle, including, of course, and most importantly for this topic, the Judeo-Christian cultural context. So the American founding, as staunch as it appears in this picture here, was the most radical event in human history from this perspective, because it is the coup de grace, you might say, of the Judeo-Christian tradition. It is the beginning of the end, and there's a linkage between this event from Schindler's perspective and the chaotic, sort of decadent, hyper-individualized, but at the same time hyper-massified culture that we now currently have. And there's a direct line between this event of the founding and the way that we have destroyed our natural environment. We have separated ourselves from it. We have decided to do whatever we wanted to with it. We have used it up in the name of our individual interpretation of freedom and pleasure. There are no constraints, at least in our minds at this point. So there's a lot of connections to be made here. I feel like I've probably done enough for one day.